I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
First dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? My dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show where we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. As you know, we have been on the hunt for a new tagline. And the reason for that, well, I think it's twofold. One, executive producer Luke just feels like we can do a bit better than the original. The original is getting under the skin of science in a good way. I really loved that. Until I found out that it was actually Michael. I was convinced it was me that had come up with it. And then Michael showed that he kept the receipts. He had the message where it's confirmed it was his idea. And I had said that was good. And so I immediately went off it. So I am now thinking we do need a new tagline because I don't like the idea that Brooksy's come up with a good one. But we're struggling. And the last one we tried was it the weekly bath?
Yeah.
Gives science its weekly bath.
The show that gives science its weekly bath.
It's so crap that it might just stick.
Oh, come on. You didn't think it was crap before?
I did.
No, I think if we go back to the previous episode where we, like, you're like, oh, it's not bad.
No, I think I said it was odd and I didn't want to have to say it.
Oh, okay.
And if you think that's me liking something. but we've got a message from Joe. He says, what about Eureka, the podcast that makes sense of science? That's not bad.
It's not bad, is it? It sort of feels like we should have come up with it ourselves.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's slightly embarrassing. Or the podcast that separates the pseudo from the science. I also quite like that, but it's not really what we do exactly, I don't
know. No, because we take actually quite sort of normal accepted science and then pull that apart as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So it's not really pseudoscience.
No.
I had a new idea.
Oh, yeah, okay.
The show that gives science its weekly wedgie.
That is so bad.
But it's,
at least you could say atomic wedgie, so it sounds a bit science.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one, yeah.
The show that gives science its weekly atomic wedgie. I think you get rid of weekly.
Yeah, you get rid of weekly.
The show that gives science an atomic wedgie.
That's brilliant.
It's not brilliant. But it is making me laugh. The show that gives science is a... No. We're still...
Fine.
The hunt continues. Maybe that's it. Eureka. The hunt continues. The hunt for a tagline continues. Anyway, enough of that. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
So, recently, I haven't listened to this back, and I don't imagine you've listened to it, but I went on the podcast How to Fail.
No, why would I go on that? One of the last winners.
Yeah, well, no, I think you know everything about failure. There's nothing it can teach you. And it's very popular, presented, interestingly, by my ex-girlfriend. And so we talked a bit about our...
Was that awkward?
Oh, no. Yeah, of course it was fucking awkward. But quite funny. It was quite funny. And also it's long enough time had elapsed. So I think we split up, I don't know, 20 years ago nearly.
Oh, okay.
So enough time's elapsed. And she's nice. And we just had quite a funny chat. And it was all fine.
Did you reference it?
Like, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, you did.
I'm going to go back and listen to that.
Would have been tricky not to. You'll really like one anecdote that sometimes this is a problem with podcasts, but also the sort of good thing about podcasts is they are very relaxed, and you do end up just saying stuff that then, in retrospect, you shouldn't have said. And I definitely did that on this occasion.
And you had no right of veto, presumably, as you do with this one, when your agent gets on the line and says, "No, that's not going out."
Yeah. Yeah. So that particular transgression is out there.
Oh, good. Okay. I look forward to that.
Yeah. But anyway, so we talked a bit about, I was saying, so the idea is you give a load of examples of failure in your life. And one of the things I was saying I'd failed at was relationships for various reasons. And so it's sort of about a little bit about heartbreak. And it made me think you've probably never experienced heartbreak because you and Philippa have been together since you were like 12 or something.
Not 12.
How old?
But sort of 17, 18.
So,
yeah.
Have you never...
I don't think I've ever really had my heart broken.
That's amazing. So you don't know what that feels like at all?
No. No. And I sort of... Until this point in my life, I hadn't realised that I was lacking something. But
yeah.
Obviously I'm lacking...
You're lacking fucking loads. Trust me. So you've been together... Yeah, I mean, essentially your whole adult life.
Yes, yeah.
Have you ever had, like, wobbles where you thought, well, did you break up for a little bit and you felt sad?
No.
I mean, I want to say you're missing out. You're not really, because it's horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
But that is quite a rich experience.
Yeah, it's been totally smooth, plain sailing at all.
No, we haven't had
a breakup.
Yeah, that... Yeah, it not being plain sailing, that's absolutely...
That's a given,
to be
isn't
expected.
It? Right, yeah.
But you've never been to the low of you've broken up and you feel terrible.
No.
That's fascinating. And I think accounts for quite a lot, actually.
What, my cheerful optimism?
Yeah, that, but also the fact that you're just a bit peculiar.
I don't think that's fair at all.
I think it is fair. I think it's like such a... such an important part of human experience.
Well,
and I feel like everyone you're really unusual not having experience.
Yeah, I appreciate that I am unusual in that, and that we're unusual in how long we've been together. Although, you know, I know
I don't think unusual in that. Like that's
but never having experienced,
never having broken up at any point, even though you. So I know people who've been together since they were that kind of age, but they've had breakups and, you know, and got back together and stuff like that. But just to be basically solid from 17, 18.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impressive in a way.
Well, I mean, you know, once you've hooked this, you're not going to let it go, are you?
I'm still doing this podcast with you. Had you had girlfriends before?
No.
So, hang on. So how did...
I feel like somehow I'm coming off badly.
Yeah. No. Look, there's an obvious question here and you don't have to answer it. But how could you know? How could either of you know that this was it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I have no idea.
With no frame of reference. I feel like my frame of reference has been so important and useful for me.
Yeah, well...
Like working out what you do,
I remember
what you don't
there was a point where I just thought, you know what, this is kind of it.
And was it that romantic?
It wasn't like that. But you know, you go through those thought processes in your head of like, you know, where is this going? Is this
what working? Are my other options?
What are my other options effectively? And it was like, you know, there was nothing in me that had any doubts that this was the relationship I wanted to stay in.
So I think that everyone feels that about their first relationship. And that's
are you saying I should still keep an open mind about this?
Look, entirely up to you. But just saying, are you on any of the apps? just have a look.
Window shopping.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you never know.
No, it's good advice. I'll
don't, Philippa, if you're listening, obviously I'm joking, but only half joking. But then, because
are you saying you think I could do better?
No, I think she could. It's her I'm worried about. I do think that first relationship for most people, it feels like everything, and it feels like it's the one.
Yeah.
And that's what makes that first heartbreak absolutely crippling. Like it's agony.
Yeah. Do you know what? There were people that I chose not to go out with, if that makes sense. Like where obviously I could have asked,
not obviously,
these girls out.
Yeah.
And I knew that they would have said yes, but I just didn't want to go out with them. You know, I kind of liked them, but not enough to go through the process of going out with them for a bit and then breaking up with them. And I think the root of this is that I don't know how to do a breakup, and I worry about that in advance. And therefore, okay, I don't get into a relationship where I'm going to need to do a breakup.
But you can't have known that.
I think I did know it.
That's...
I honestly think I did know it. Maybe it's coming from, you know, from a kind of, you know, that whole broken home thing, you know, never met my father.
Interesting, yeah.
You know, I'd never had any kind of, you know...
Can we say the thing about the birthday card, please? It's really amazing. So when I arrived today, Michael is sitting there, very sweet, just waiting for me. And he's got a card on the table in its envelope, all stamped and addressed and ready to go. And it's for his father's 80th birthday.
Yes.
And the detail about this is...
This is the first birthday card I've ever sent him.
Amazing. It's like it's sort of both awful and really cute at the same time. maybe that is it.
I'm
loving this therapy session. Not very scientific, but it's great.
And we've got a whole episode to do yet, you know. But actually, I think the thing for me is that I don't think I would be very good at breaking up a relationship. I think if I got into a relationship, I'd probably stay in it even when I didn't want to be in it.
That's not
my marriage, by the way.
Yeah, okay. This was basically what I was saying on Elizabeth's on.
Oh, really?
Phone. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm not very good at it, and I just sort of stagnate. So Elizabeth and I, she disagreed with this, which was in itself reasonably awkward. We were together, and then we broke up, and then we got back together again, and I was like, we shouldn't have got back together again. Oh. That was just a waste of time. And she's like, oh, no, I think we should.
Really?
And I was like,
So listening to this.
I think I stayed in several relationships for way too long.
Because you didn't know how to get out.
Oh,
you didn't know how to make a clean break.
No, that...
Didn't want to hurt somebody.
A bit of laziness, a bit of like, well, this is fine. This is fine. Which is not great.
No, it's not.
So I'm
not taking that to the altar,
yeah,
are you?
So I feel, I feel for you, in the kind of not knowing how to break up.
Okay,
stakes.
Well, I reject your sympathy. I'm fine. Okay. Thank you very much.
So anyway, we're going to talk about heartbreak. Who hasn't asked themselves the same aching question framed by the Bee Gees, how can you mend a broken heart? Or in my case, spent a week listening to Save Tonight by Eagle Eye Cherry on repeat, crying into my pillowcase. True story. There's a sheer, abject misery in heartbreak. That's not quite like anything else. You find yourself asking, how will it ever be possible to exist without this person? But what in our bodies actually causes us this immense physical and emotional anguish when we lose someone? Could it even kill you? Find out as we ask, what's the use of a broken heart? this week we've got an expert.
What, despite your expertise on broken hearts?
Well, I think I don't have any... I've got the experience. I don't have any... I've never really thought about the sort of scientific angle of it before now. And it's genuinely quite interesting.
Okay.
Well, I suppose you'll be the judge of that. And this week we're joined by Mary Frances O'Connor. She is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Arizona. So she directs the Grief, Loss and Social Stress Lab, which sounds like a lot of fun.
That's not a workplace you want to go into, is it?
How are you enjoying work? Well, what do you think? And they investigate the effects of grief on the brain and the body. She's also the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss.
That's amazing. I'm reeling from that, the fact that that lab exists.
When I was doing my reading around this, it's kind of fascinating that a lot of research and a lot of time has gone into scientific investigation of the experience of being in love.
Yeah.
So how that, you know, what chemical changes does that create? What behavioural changes? Are there physical changes? Does it affect your longevity? Does it affect your happiness? All these kind of things.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite well studied. But until fairly recently, the sort of the end of love hadn't really been studied that much. And it seems like an obvious thing. So I can't think who it is, but there's some philosopher who made a quote along the lines of, when you invent the ship, you also invent shipwrecks. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
When you have love,
I like that.
You have to have the loss of love. And the loss of love is painful and worth investigating. And so people have done now. And this cheery sounding lab is just one example. But the first thing that I wanted to talk to Mary Frances about was whether heartbreak. So again, you don't know what the fuck I'm talking about here, but the physical pain that you feel after that, is that rooted in anything physical in my body?
There's absolutely incontrovertible evidence of the broken heart phenomena. And we know this actually from research starting back in the 1960s. But what I mean by that is, this is the increased rate of mortality for the person who has experienced the death of a loved one. So to say it more simply, if a man, if his wife dies, he himself is at higher risk for mortality, almost twice as high as another man who remains married in the first few weeks and months after the death of his spouse.
Is that really true? If you're heartbroken, you're more like twice as likely to die, or basically you've lost your partner.
Yeah.
You're twice as likely to die, and not just from starvation, presumably.
No.
Just
your mortality rate.
You're literally, your body's just like, there's no point being here anymore.
But do you know what's amazing about that? Is that that's true of men. So if a man loses their partner, then their mortality rate is massively increased.
Right.
If a woman loses her partner, no change in her mortality.
No change.
Absolutely fine.
Well, who needs who?
Yeah. Well, it's quite clear, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where you're like, oh, is this sort of gender stereotyping? But it really stands up when you look at the data.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, my grandma lived, my nana lived for 30 years after her husband died.
Yeah.
He died at 63.
Mm-hmm.
And well, she was, 90? I think she was 93 when she died, or 91 to 93. So, you know, clearly coped. I mean, I'm sure she was sad, but I it wouldn't surprise me if the other way around, it had just been a case of, oh, can't really do this.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, that's what all of the data suggests.
That's amazing.
Yeah, men are just like, oh, God.
I'm gonna make sure I die first.
Luckily, your life expectancy will be much lower.
Oh, that is lucky.
You probably will die first.
Yeah, that is lucky.
Yeah, finally, Philippa escapes this relationship.
She should get better at breaking up with people.
But women do experience it. So if, and this is like really bleak, but for maternal grief, so if a child dies, then female mortality, I think it goes up like 130% or something. Like it's really ramped up. So something is going on here. This isn't something you can just dismiss as, oh, you're just feeling a bit sad.
Yeah, yeah, it's not just an emotion, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, and actually, if you think about what love is, I haven't quite worked this out in my head, but I think this is right. I don't think love is an emotion per se, in the sense that emotions are kind of quite, well, A, you can see them on people's faces. I think that's quite a good metric for an emotion. So if you're happy, okay, yeah, smiling, unhappy, frowning, shocked, like do you know what I mean?
There's yeah, sort of, yeah.
Whereas love, I think, is a much more complicated package than that. And it's more like a sort of, this is not a very romantic way of putting it, but it's sort of goal-oriented kind of motivation. And so the goal in this case is to be with and maintain being with the object of your love.
I can't believe we didn't put this out for Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I know. I can't believe I didn't put this in the vows. The thing about love is not really an emotion, is it? It's all about goals and motivation.
It's about social utility.
Yeah, your favourite. So
you're defining love as something that is not just an emotion, but is deeply interconnected with your kind of plans for the future,
yeah,
your kind of, you know, sense of who you are, how you fit into everything around you, and what support you have in some ways, you know, for the rest of your life.
Yeah, but the sort of looking at the actual physical processes, I think, is interesting. The physical processes associated with not just love, which we'll sort of come to, but heartbreak itself. So there is actually a thing called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, which you might have heard of or come across. So it's
not pronounced like that. Anyway.
It's that was, honestly, I speak no Japanese.
you surprised me.
It's called broken heart syndrome.
Okay,
and you see it like quite often, really. And what appears to happen is your body is flooded with stress hormones in the wake of whatever the situation is. That seems to kind of weaken your left ventricle of your heart, literally in your heart, and it kind of changes shape and I think gets bigger and becomes worse at properly pumping blood around you. And in the most extreme cases, just gives up. So you can literally die of a broken heart, a heart that has stopped working.
That's immense. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So you
see what you're missing out on. This is good stuff.
So this is my whole philosophy is live life as stress-free as possible. Obviously, that's a very good thing because obviously stress hormones are really bad for you.
Yeah. I mean, that, and also, by the way, that would hurt. That would That would physically hurt. Yeah.
Amazing.
Mm. And so heartbreak has been looked at, and you can, there's all sorts of effects that have been documented. So from cognitive decline to increased anxiety, I mean, these are all kind of fairly obvious, I think. Maybe cognitive decline isn't. Fragmented sleep.
Yeah. Not that you'd notice that.
Bad, no, Christ. I mean, I wish I had any sleep to fragment. bad impulse control, so people making really poor decisions in the wake of it. Depression, and then the classic early death.
So why is it you wishing this upon me?
No, I'm saying it's quite.
Oh, you've missed out. You've really missed out.
No, but I think you have because you get through it.
Yeah, if that's you don't the thing. Die,
you get through it. Yeah, okay. I'm not suggesting you do it now because I think that might do for you because you're old. But earlier, you should have got it done earlier when you're basically going to be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're not going to, you know, if you're breaking up when you're in your 20s,
you're not getting a swollen left ventricle.
You might feel like you're going to die, but you're probably not going to.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas now, you might do. and if you, so this is something that is quite striking. So if you do a brain scan of someone who is heartbroken, the same parts of the brain will light up as a person who has just suffered like a burn, a physical burn. So it looks like the sort of emotional pain and physical pain pathways have kind of evolved concurrently.
So it genuinely is pain.
It's genuinely pain, yeah.
Yeah, I'm quite glad I've never been through this.
but my point is, I suppose you have to take it seriously.
Yeah,
like it's a proper thing, and I don't think people realise that.
Yeah, it's to be avoided. Don't break up with anyone.
that is not what I'm saying. Obviously, to really understand what's going on with grief and heartbreak, you have to kind of work out what state your brain is in when you're in love and then what you lose. So I asked Mary Frances about that.
You can't really talk about grief and loss without first talking about love and bonding, because that is what gets lost. So we know from studies of little tiny rodents that when they pair bond, some rodents called voles pair bond for life. And we see the epigenetic changes that happen in their brain that say, this vole is the one for me, and I will prefer this vole over any other vole for the rest of my life. Now, once that bond is formed in the brain, it means that when you're separated, you automatically have this response of part of me is missing. But the reason that we get separated, the reasons that we experience grief and loss, can be lots of different kinds of changes to that bond. So it can be a divorce or a breakup. It can be estrangement from an adult child. It can be finding out that this person is no longer the person that you thought that they were. So there are lots of ways that that bond can be broken. And because it's about the separation from that person, it doesn't have to be their death. We even know that in, 4 to 7 days that a partner has gone on a business trip, we can see physiological changes in the partner that are completely reversible. But you see how any kind of separation, when there was a bond there, is really what's causing that experience of grief and loss.
Well, I just booked a business trip, but only for 3 days. So I'm going to Geneva for 3 days in April. I should have made it 4 just so Philippa might miss me.
Yeah. I mean, could you extend it and then we hook Philippa up to an fMRI and see what's going on?
Well, she did actually suggest that I extended it. So obviously, sense of like, you're not really going away for long enough. I thought you were going to say, can we hook her up to like Tinder or something?
I think she'll probably do that herself. I mean, why is she asking you to extend the trip? You've got to ask these questions. You'll be unsurprised here that I'm quite interested in the sort of evolutionary benefits, potential benefits of this. Because in a way, you're like, why would... Is this serving any purpose?
Well, this is how we started this whole process of looking at this, isn't it? Because we were talking about... That's exactly the question you asked.
Yeah.
When your cat died.
Well, yeah, actually, yeah. Because my cat died. I was away with work. And, I mean... I was so broken by it, and so sad, and we had a conversation. We're like, I just don't know. Doesn't feel like this is serving me in any way.
Yeah, it was a very conversation, wasn't it? It's like you're really sad about your cat, and you want to know the evolutionary purpose
but
from
also
that sadness.
Why would I? And I still feel that sadness. It's not sort of there the whole time, but it is triggered by something that you will find quite funny, which is we had to get all of the cat's stuff, obviously, and move it from the kitchen where it was, because I couldn't have that out. And so we've whacked it all into the little porch that we don't really go in. But what we haven't done is taken the batteries out of the automatic feeder. So every morning and every night, you just hear the telltale that was always followed by the pitter patter of Tippy's footsteps to go to the food. And so I just hear it like most days, and I'm like, fucking hell.
You've got to take those batteries out.
Yeah, but I still can't bring myself to go and sort of deal with all of our stuff.
That's like, I mean, I've still got the phone number of a friend who died in my phone because I can't take it out.
Yeah.
It just feels like it's the wrong thing to do.
How long ago did they die?
I think it's probably 6 or 7 years ago, if not more.
Yeah. No, do you occasionally see it in your phone and sort of get a pang of...
Yeah. It's like, oh, there's Tim's
But I know what
number.
You mean. Yeah. Like, you wouldn't want to...
But why, you know, it's fine. It almost reminds me that, you know, he was around.
It's not
necessarily a terrible thing. It's sort of like, okay, Tim was around and he's not anymore.
It would feel really nasty, I think, to delete it for like such a...
I don't think I'd like to be the kind of person who would just like, all right, we'll get rid of that. We'll save a couple of megabytes in the memory.
How long's his phone number?
All right, kilobytes maybe.
Yeah. So anyway, the evolutionary sort of angle was the thing I was interested in. And the sort of social pain of separation in our ancestors. So not necessarily humans, but sort of pre-humans or whatever, like... lurching around on the savannah, trying to find food and trying to avoid getting eaten.
Yeah.
Safety in numbers is absolutely key there. And if you are excluded in any way from the group or from your mate, it pretty much is like certain death.
Yeah.
Like it's really, really bad news. And so in exactly the same way that you'd say physical pain is sort of signalling that there's maybe a life-threatening injury and you need to do something about it. The emotional pain of separation alerts you to the fact you need to get back to your group, get back to your partner, because otherwise you're fucked.
Yeah.
And I think it is that. I think that's probably where it comes from.
Served a purpose.
Yes, and you'd say doesn't probably really serve a purpose anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah, apart from to make sure that you don't break up with anyone through your entire life.
Yeah, yes, they're serving that purpose magnificently with you. But I do think that they have, as I said, like the physical and emotional pain has sort of evolved on the same pathway as it's just a warning to threat and a cue to pay close attention, because something has gone wrong or is going wrong.
Yeah, don't do anything that will get you separated out from the group.
Exactly. I want to talk about voles. We'll talk about voles after, of course, I do. After a quick break, when we get back, we'll be discussing voles, whether young heartbreak hits the hardest. Feels like a yes to me. Cures for a broken heart, and we'll be answering today's question: what is the use of a broken heart?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And we're back. So, Vols, do you remember in our Can Dating Apps Engineer Love episode, there are two types of, or there's lots of types of vole, but there's two specific types that are quite closely related. So the meadow vole and the prairie vole. And the prairie vole is really monogamous. So 75% of prairie voles will stick with the same partner for their entire life. Yeah. And the meadow vole is a slut. That it just like fucks everyone, like it's really promiscuous. And there's a
vasopressin receptors.
Exactly.
You can blame them for any misdemeanors.
Yeah. That was their conclusion. Yeah. So you can.
Of course, I stored that one away.
Yeah. That's important information. So it's a difference. It seems to be in their brain chemistry or the type of receptors that they've got in a particular area of the brain, and you can manipulate the brains of either. And make them do the other thing. So you can get a meadow vole and inject it, I think it is with a virus, and it will become monogamous by interfering with its receptors. And then you can do a similar thing with the prairie vole that switches on some receptors, and then it suddenly becomes like a fuck machine.
Which is all science should ever do.
Yeah, it's just, can we turn this one into a fuck machine and this one into Brooksy?
Don't be cruel. So in something like Mary Frances's lab, obviously they're doing experiments, or scientists generally are doing experiments to like look at these people and what's going on with them physically.
Yeah.
And presumably the stuff in the brain that's the most interesting.
Yes, I think so. Or the sort of the consequences of what's going on in the brain.
Yeah, because I mean, you can do an autopsy and do the heart thing. It's like, oh yeah, they had a broken heart.
But you want to know, what's happening with various chemicals in the brain and various activity in the brain and how that correlates with other activity in the brain of sort of events that we understand a bit better.
Yeah.
So they do fMRI and MRI studies. And when they're looking for heartbroken people, they tend to obviously just go to universities. Young people are always heartbroken.
Undergraduates, yeah.
Yeah, that was my first, my Eagle Eye Cherry heartbreak was when I was 19, I guess. And I listened to, that one song. I honestly think for a week on repeat.
Amazing.
Extraordinary stuff from me. Yeah. And there was it was such a bad, I've got back together with that girl actually. Terrible again. like an awful match. We were an awful match.
Really?
Yeah. But I absolutely didn't think that at the time. So there we go. Madness. But you also find that you end up kind of functioning as a unit with your partner, by which I mean your body sort of sync up, so your heartbeats start to regulate, and your cortisol levels sort of line up, and your respiration rates align, and all this kind of
is that only when you're in the room together, or just like generally?
That's a good question, actually. I don't know. I assume you probably when you're in the room.
Yeah,
it must sort of deviate off, otherwise it's a bit spooky, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it must be when you're together.
There must be some kind of... Because you have a sense of your own pulse, even though you're not aware of it. There's been psychology experiments that show that people will sort of regulate things according to their pulse. I know that. So I guess maybe you get a sense of other people's pulse, and it just sort of, it gets, if you're physically close enough, you can kind of sense it, and you get this kind of synchrony occur.
Yeah. But I mean, that is weird, isn't it?
It is weird. I mean, it's sort of we're quite social beings, aren't we? So I think there's a lot of our behaviour. It's like mirroring, you know, when you're like sitting opposite somebody and you end up sort of doing exactly the same body postures.
Yeah.
And it's a completely unconscious thing, but it's all about facilitating social engagement.
Yeah.
And I guess it must be a sort of similar thing. It's kind of weird that you can do it with like your inner workings effectively, but I can imagine that, you know, evolution has kind of equipped us to that level.
We had a guest on the radio show this morning who was talking about something or other, and he just goes, and actually there's a guy called Robin Dunbar. Don't know if you would have come across him. And I was like,
pressing the buzzer. Excuse me.
Yes. I think I know who that is. Thank you. And I had to resist the urge to bellow that. So be like, oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, I imagine he'd have something to say about this stuff.
Yeah.
But I wanted to sort of go back to this point about whether you are more affected by heartbreak when you're younger. I mean, you don't hear about young people dying of heartbreak, basically.
No.
Whereas, you know, as we know, mortality rates do increase for certainly for men in later life if they have their hearts broken. So I kind of wanted to ask Mary Frances about this. Does heartbreak change with age?
As we age, we learn a lot about ourselves. We learn a lot about how relationships work. We learn about how we work as individuals. And that first loss that we have, which is often followed the very first bonding that we have with a peer, right, with a romantic partner, that first loss can often be intense because we've never experienced it before. And so we have no way of saying, I'm going to get through this, right? It feels unbearable. And although losses later in life feel unbearable, we do have lived experience that, although they feel unbearable, we do manage to go on. And we do come to a place eventually where we're able to think of that loved one and not completely fall apart. But early losses, because we're not as able to understand our own emotions, they seem unfamiliar and often out of our control. I think those early losses have a very specific feeling to them.
So you've never felt that kind of pain before, and so it's a kind of very intense experience.
Yeah.
And then as you get older, it seems to be implying it's sort of less of a big deal in that you know that you can get over it and except, you know, when you're in, obviously, in later life and then you just die of a broken heart.
Yeah, if you're a man.
If you're a man.
And if you're a woman, get on with it.
Yeah, you just get on with it.
Absolutely fine. Yeah. Don't really miss the guy, actually. Turns out. So here's something for you to think about. When I describe some of these sort of effects in the brain, what does it immediately remind you of? So when you have heartbreak, you're white blood cells, this is complicated. I didn't really understand it to be honest when I read it, but I was like, that's interesting. They sort of can monitor your mood and things like loneliness and react and therefore increase inflammation.
So which like is an inflammation.
Inflammation is never good, right?
No.
Your dopamine levels decrease. Your oxytocin levels decrease. You get a kind of withdrawal. You can get like tremors and palpitations. You can get depressed. And also the way that your dopamine spikes when you're in love means that you can sort of become dependent on it.
This is addiction, isn't it?
That's exactly what it is. It's not, so love is not like being addicted, it is an addiction.
Physiologically,
it's the same. It's the same thing. And so, all of the when you take that away, you take the drug away, you take the love away, you end up with withdrawal, and you know all sorts of negative consequences. And you understand that kind of panic trying to get it back.
Yeah, it sounds like an essential human experience to me.
Yeah. Still not sold on it.
No.
I mean, I don't know what to tell you. No one can quite work out what exactly the mechanism is that is making your your heart hurt,
yeah,
effectively. But there's one idea that I quite liked, which is that it simultaneously sort of activates your sympathetic activation system, which is your fight or flight.
Yeah.
So like increasing your heart rate, yeah, increasing like sort of, you know, breathing rate, respiration rate. And also your parasympathetic activation system, which is your rest and digest sort of system.
So it doesn't know what to
do. So basically, you're like whacking the accelerator and the brake on the heart at the same time. Your heart's just like, nah! I don't know if that's true, but I thought it's a good it's a good analogy.
Yeah, yeah. My cardiovascular system is not the best anyway, so I'm definitely not up for any of this.
So you're still no consideration here of breaking up with Philippa?
No, but that wouldn't break my heart, would it? If I did the breaking up, well, it would eventually because I'd regret it, and then
And also, I don't think it's necessarily true that only the person who is dumped is heartbroken.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, yeah. So you can be heartbroken that you feel you have to dump somebody.
Yeah, and logically you can think, well, I've made the right decision, but I think emotionally and in terms of your addiction, you're still going to be having some problems.
Yeah, okay.
This is really spicy, ethically, I think, whether it's possible to sort of cure heartbreak. And I think this is quite a bad idea, because fundamentally I do believe that you're sort of, not you, but people are learning, like, some of this stuff is useful. Like, you're learning stuff about yourself and you're learning to cope on your own, and this is all quite beneficial. And if you can just pop a pill and it's just done, I don't know, like...
Oh, you're so old school.
I think
no pain, no gain.
I do, but do you not think it's true in this case?
But you would
of
do
course
that.
You
a,
don't.
You would do that for a hangover, wouldn't you? You wouldn't
but
say, no, you've got to learn the lessons of drinking. No, you'd take the pill.
What, and then just repeatedly really drunk?
If it's not problematic with no consequences, then yeah, it's fine, isn't it?
Again, you're the wrong person to talk to about this, clearly. But the sort of period that you have, basically...
Of reflection.
So there's like
How long is it? Like 6 weeks? I remember reading somewhere.
It can be longer than that.
Really?
There's two distinct phases, I think. There's sort of protest,
yeah,
which is like where you're just... You are refusing to accept it. And you want to try and get that person back.
Right.
Which is sort of just like hypervigilance, really, where you're just panicking and you're desperately trying it. So this, again, going back to the evolutionary idea, this would have been really useful so that you're like really active in trying to retrieve the thing that you've lost, i.e. get back to the group.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that gives way to resignation. and that's where I think you do the learning and you think about, well, what did I do wrong? What did they do wrong? Is there anything that I've learned about the sort of person that would be that I'm good with?
I mean, I understand the theory of what you're saying, right?
But I think it's true.
Plenty of people don't learn anything from their breakups.
You know
that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
And every listener knows that's true as well.
But it might not be immediately obvious, but maybe they are learning stuff. Just because you make the same mistakes again and again doesn't mean you're not learning anything, I guess.
Okay.
Maybe I'm clutching a bit there.
So can we, I mean, is there a positive? Like, I know you don't like the idea of a pill, but there must be a way to sort of shorten, circumvent, get around this problem, because it's not evolutionarily useful these days, is it? It used to be. So let's bypass it, surely.
Well, I asked Mary Frances about the prospect of a cure.
I think one of the most important things is to understand that heartbreak is normal. That it is the natural response to being separated from a loved one. Now, that doesn't mean that it isn't the right thing to be separated from a loved one. Say you're getting a divorce, you may have intense yearning and also know that this is not the right relationship for you. So I think just even understanding that it is a natural physiological response that we have, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we need to do something different. I think it also is helpful because we really recognize how stressful grief and loss and separation are on the human body. And so finding ways to help your body to relax, to find comfort, those are really important coping skills in learning to regulate your own physiology without this other person. And so, you know, that looks different for different people. For some people, that's going for a long run that exhausts you. For another person, that's doing yoga that feels very relaxing. For another person, that might be guided meditation that makes you feel safe and comfortable. I think the important thing is listening to your body and finding those things that can help you to feel more relaxed and give your body a break from this updating it's trying to do, trying to understand what the world is like now for you, given that you're carrying the absence of this person.
You know, you just got to tell yourself you'll get over it.
You'd be a great therapist. Oh, come on.
How long has it been now?
Your 6 weeks is up, like your idea's up. So there is some genuinely fascinating research that's been done into whether you can treat heartbreak in a way that you would treat another condition. And so there's a guy in, I think he's Canadian. Yeah, I think he's in Montreal. And he's looked at whether you can... sort of, so he's not looking at the symptoms of it all. He's just like, he's literally seeing if you can treat the memories. Because what he's saying is that love is, in some senses, it's like a really strong emotional attachment to memories is what it is. So, when you're heartbroken, you keep sort of thinking back to all of these great moments with this person. Yeah. And that's really difficult. And so what he does is he tries to reconsolidate the memory but remove the trauma. And so the way that he does it is he says, okay, you're going to tell me this story about the thing, you know, with your ex, but before that you're going to take a beta blocker.
Oh, okay.
And that means that when you sort of relate the memory, it gets re-encoded, if you like. When you relay a memory, it sort of goes back in, but slightly different. And this type goes in with less trauma because the drug just suppresses the pain effectively.
Okay.
And you do that quite a lot until you get to a point, it's like 4 or 6 sessions of this, where you've still got the, because you don't want to get rid of the, it's not like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. You don't want to like just erase the memory.
Yeah.
You've still got the memory, but you just don't, you've lost the pain that is associated with it. And it seems to work. And people are like, yeah, it kind of feels like I'm like reading a novel is the phrase. Right. Like,
does it work because you just, it's 6 weeks has passed and you're over it now?
Well, that's possible, isn't it? That is possible. but everyone seems to, like, certainly the participants seem to think that it's done something wasn't going to happen without them, and they're probably quite unreliable.
I've heard of similar things with MDMA.
Yeah.
You go through therapy and it sort of takes the trauma out of the memory.
That's it. Taking trauma out of the memory is the key. So just taking the drug won't do it. Just doing the sort of the therapy exercise of retelling the story won't do it. But together, it seems to. And what's really, I think, really interesting, he was originally developed it for PTSD.
Yeah.
Because that's an obvious place where you want to try and remove trauma from memories. He, like, the big pharma aren't interested because the beta blocker, its patent is up.
So anyone can
make it. So everyone's just like, well, no, not interested. It's so interesting. I always forget that about big pharma, in America at least, that once a license is up, they've got to make money, haven't they? They can't make, and they are, to be fair to them, they are making
money. You can't pay those multi-million dollar bonuses if you're not making some money.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point. So that is an option. There's another one. There's like, there's a drug which is an anesthetic, similar idea. Again, trying to mute these painful memories, and that can
the memories are the same as physical pain.
Yeah, exactly.
So
anesthetic kind of does a similar job. Yeah, and that happens really quickly. So that's definitely not a passage of time thing. So if you retell a distressing story, so this is like actually PTSD, but it sort of applies to, you know, being heartbroken as well. you then get injected with the drug immediately afterwards, and then you recount it again 24 hours later, and the memory is much less vivid and much less painful.
I mean, it feels like it's really open to abuse, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah, it really does. Yeah. But it's quite, I mean, you know, the possibilities are there. There's also some stuff which where you do sort of neurofeedback. So it's the old, cap of electrical wires.
Yeah.
And I'm like, get that away from me.
No, I mean, at some point you've got to say, you know what, you're just going to have to
go over
this.
I'm just going to deal with it. Yeah, yeah, I don't want this.
I'm just chloroforming myself. You know, yeah. I'll just tell you this story, then I'll knock myself out.
Yeah, and then I'm good. But you've got... selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Yeah. So those, which are very common, they sort of have a blunting effect on everything, and that including the way that you feel about other people, emotions towards other people. So they could also be possibly useful. But
I quite like the idea that we're just going to find a way to medicate away heartbreak, and then no poets or philosophers are going to have anything to do in the future. It's like, not really anything to write about. Yeah,
no. Yeah, because you're always fine.
You're fine.
You just immediately go and you basically go to the chemist, go, like, I've got a prescription for heartbreak, and you sort it out within a week.
Yeah, 4,000 years of poetry.
It's like, gone.
It's gone.
And also no one interested in listening to it,
nobody
reading
wants to read it.
It's like, what the fuck's this? Yeah.
This is a bit miserable, isn't it?
What's wrong with these pussies? Take the beta blocker. So I asked Mary Frances the question, what is the use of a broken heart?
The broken heart is very useful when we have a loved one who is out of our sight, and it motivates us to go find them, to bring us back together, to resolve an argument, or to apologize for something you've done. But the kind of broken heart that happens when a loved one can no longer be retrieved, that you can't be with them anymore, whether that's death or divorce, then the broken heart takes on a new level, and we have to learn how to live in this world again and restore a meaningful life for ourselves without them.
I cannot believe that I forgot to tell you about a really horrible test on voles.
Go on.
That I'm going to tell you because you'll
like
it.
Very quickly.
It's like an addendum, really. So the voles that love each other, the prairie voles.
Yeah.
It's so out of order. You do a series of tests where some of them you split up and some of them you don't. Mm. So some of them are in heavy quotation marks, heartbroken, and some of them are quite happy. And then you do, there's one test called the forced swim test, which is about us. It's exactly what it sounds like. You just drop them into a glitter cold water and it really is like... In a beaker, and they're just desperately trying to get out of the cold water.
See, you're breaking my heart now.
So that, and then even worse, actually, the tail suspension test, where you duct tape them to like a stick, and then hang them in a black box. And then there's one where you put them in a maze where it's kind of elevated, and you can stay if you're feeling nervous or whatever. You can stay in the kind of in the bits of the maze that are closed in, and if you're feeling sort of, you know, adventurous, you can go out into the clear bottomed bits that feel quite risky.
Yeah.
Anyway, what you see is obviously a load of really unhappy voles, but the ones that are heartbroken, they just basically give up.
Yeah, they don't bother
swimming,
do they?
They do this sort of passive coping, which people say is quite like depression, where they just they don't flail when they're suspended by their tail. They're just like, fuck it. They don't really try and fight their way out of the cold water. Just
what
like,
are the ethics for these
experiments? I know.
What are you writing on your grant proposal? It's like, well, there's a load of teenagers who are really a bit sad and we want to help them.
And we're thinking, should we torture some voles?
That's terrible.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah.
But
that's not Mary Frances doing that, is it?
That is not Mary Frances. Do you know what? I'll name and shame the guy. That is someone called Oliver Bosch. Shame on you! but yeah, so there you go.
So what's the use of a broken heart? Well, I mean, I think she made some good points. It like gets you to take action maybe in the right direction.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean,
I can see that.
You're sort of in like an elevated danger state.
Yeah.
That's the kind of, from an evolutionary point of view, that's what you're in. And you're just trying to get back to safety.
But my philosophy is it's best not to get in there in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Has this given you any food for thought?
None whatsoever.
No?
No.
Do you think when Philippa listens to this, it might give her
yeah,
something?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
next week, we pitch up and Brooksy is devastated. He's like, well, I can't believe it, but Philippa, she's packed her things. She's gone.
No, it'd be me that got thrown out.
Yeah, true.
She's not stupid.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Associate Professor Mary Frances O'Connor. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also really love hearing from you guys, so if you have any burning questions you want us to answer, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london, or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.